get started. Off day. We have a smaller crowd Monday. We offer everybody sits. So we have no homework to go over today because I gave you a week. We'll do that on Thursday. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about the homework?
You can ask a question. Yeah, sure.
We're comparing very strict two-phase locking, strict two-phase locking, and then ordinary two-phase locking. Do we get to release the locks as early as possible in each of those schemes, consistent with the definition of the scheme?
Yes. I don't know. Can you hear that at the other end?
No.
You
got, okay. The question was whether in assignment three, whether you can assume that locks are released as early as possible, consistent with the definition of very strict two-phase locking, strict two-phase locking and ordinary two-phase locking. And the answer is yes. That's sort of what makes it interesting, in fact. Right? One of the things it does, anyway. Are there any questions on the last lecture on locking? No. Great. Are there any questions about the project that you think are... I've been getting mail from various people. The interesting thing, the reason why I want to do this sort of privately in email is that different people they sort of get stuck on different aspects of their design that they want to discuss, so I think it's better to target it to each of you individually. The questions don't tend to answer. The answers to one tend not to answer the questions that other people have. Just want me to start talking. Oh, we got one. Yeah.
What's the use of the start call? I mean, why should I get my transaction from the transaction manager? Why don't I just new one up and have it implicitly notice it the first time someone enlists in it?
Okay, so the question is why have a start command for the transaction manager? Transactions are objects. They have an object ID. They've got to come from somewhere.
Right.
It could be that the transaction manager, I don't want to turn this into a discussion of two-phase commit, but which is where my answer is heading. But what are the alternatives? One alternative is that the application running the transaction could create its own transaction ID independently. And then you would have to have some rules for how you generate transaction IDs, like it's a GUID or something that cannot be duplicated. And everybody would have to live with that. That would be one possibility. Another possibility is that the first time every time a resource manager is accessed transactionally by a client application, the resource manager can respond with the transaction ID if that transaction doesn't yet exist. That seems kind of weird in terms of kind of overlapping function. I mean, the resource manager should be told what transaction is executing. You don't just sort of do an access on behalf of an arbitrary application, say, hey, I'm running inside of a transaction. I'm not going to tell you what my transaction ID is, so why don't you go get one for me? I mean, if you're going to do that, it should really go to the source and get it from the source. So, I think it's just a modularity encapsulation thing that the transaction manager is the body of software responsible for transactions, and that's where transactions get created and destroyed. It just should all be in one place. It's not the only way to do it, but it's kind of the standard way to do it.
can just assume that file renaming is atomic.
Can you assume that file renaming is atomic?
Yeah, or do we write the
wrong? I think it's okay to assume it's atomic. Anything else? Okay, I want to start out by just mentioning a few miscellaneous project issues that may not come up for you this week in terms of your what you turn in on Thursday, but there are a couple of topics that are not going to be covered in lecture for a little while, and if you're cranking ahead on the project, then you probably need to know what's on the next few slides, or at least know where to look to find the answer. I don't want to get into the same level of detail that I will when the topic naturally comes up in lecture, but if you're making lots of progress on the project, you might come across these. So there's three or four issues here. The first is lock conversion, which is step three of the course project, and which, I think I said something about it. I guess it was in an email message, but lock conversion is the problem of upgrading a read lock to a write lock, or not a problem, it is the activity. Lock conversion is the activity of upgrading a read lock to a write lock. In most lock managers, each lock has exactly one mode, and either read or write, may have other modes which we'll come across later, but when a transaction first obtains a read lock and then subsequently gets a write lock, normally you don't think of that as having acquired a second lock on behalf of the same transaction, but rather you've upgraded the read lock to a write lock, and that the write lock protects you for both reading and writing. The main reason to leave this out of the lock manager and have this be part of step three was to get you to read the lock manager code and to think a little bit about lock managers in general. In the past, a couple of enterprising students who know something about lock managers read the code and said, God, I hate this lock manager, and they just went off and wrote their own. But what we found from early offerings of the project that for some people, writing the lock manager turned out to be most of the project. They really got hung up on that and getting it to be fast and having the right level of synchronization when you've got lots of transactions going at it and getting client transactions to block properly. There's a lot of little things going on in there that require some thought if you've never gone through it before. So the goal here is just to get you into the lock manager, reading it, thinking about it, seeing what it does, understanding it. Deadlocks are an issue in this case. If two transactions both set read locks on the same piece of data, say X, and then they both try to convert their read lock to a write lock, they're going to obviously deadlock. So, in other words, when you convert a read lock to a write lock, you're not releasing the read lock and then obtaining the write lock. That would break two-phase locking. You're actually adding another lock, so you're sort of expanding the scope, if you will, of the read lock without releasing it. So lock conversions can easily cause deadlocks, and in fact it's one of the most common kinds of deadlock, if not the most common kind. So we're going to talk about ways of getting around it, but just as a prelude, just so you have something to work with, one possibility is to have a caller get a write lock first and then downgrade it to a read lock if it doesn't need to write. So the idea is, you know, you can imagine a transaction reading some data, and it needs to see the data before it decides whether it's going to update it. So the natural thing is first to get a read lock, take a look at what's inside the data, and then convert it to a write lock. But if you want to avoid this deadlock, you could do it the other way around, which is first you set a write lock, you read the data, and if after reading it you say, oh, I don't need to write that after all, then you downgrade it to a read lock. This is not a violation. It sounds like a violation of two-phase locking because you're releasing a lock. But it's not, because you're releasing a lock you never needed in the first place. You got a write lock to cover a write operation you decided not to perform, but you did perform the read, so you need to retain it as a read lock. So if you get a write lock first, that prevents this deadlock, right? Because whoever you will never get two transactions owning the read lock in a situation where they both try to convert. But there is one unfortunate negative. Transaction one sets a write lock on X, it reads X, decides it doesn't need to update it, downgrades its write lock to a read lock. Great. Now transaction two shows up, it wants to read X, and it's following the same strategy to avoid these conversion deadlocks, but it cannot set a write lock on X because transaction one has a read lock. And this is especially unfortunate if transaction two really only wants to read. If it turns out that after looking at the content of X, it might be satisfied reading. So, you can go down this path, right? You can start thinking about, well, maybe it could get a read lock, and then if it turns out it really did need to write, then, so it tries to get the write lock, it fails to get the write lock, instead of being blocked, the lock bounces, and it gets a reply saying, you can't set that write lock, someone has a read lock. That's not standard locking strategy, but you could have the lock manager work that way, optionally. In other words, bounce back, tell me if, don't block me if I can't get the write lock, just tell me that I didn't get it. In which case, I will try to get the read lock, and if I fail to, if after reading it, I discover that I really do want to convert to a write lock, I'll commit suicide. I'll abort the transaction because I know I'm about to. I could be generating a deadlock. Maybe, So there, and on and on. I mean, we could follow this down. You start working through different scenarios and what reasonable strategies might be. Okay, enough on that. We'll talk more about that when I get to part two of concurrency control. Starting with step five, you're implementing something called a workflow controller, which I called a request controller in chapter one, and which is called a request controller throughout the book, because we renamed it in revising the book. These names are all ours. I mean, there's no standard terms like front end or workflow controller or transaction server. Resource manager is a standard term. But there are no standard words for most of the other layers of the system. So in order to talk about them, we had to come up with words. Workflow controller, we decided, was a little bit misleading because it suggests that you're really running a workflow, which the word workflow, it turns out, has a technical connotation, which we'll get to later in the course. But it seemed better to back off on that and just call it a request controller, since what it's really doing is routing requests, whether or not the request requires the execution of a workflow. So that said, it depends on a bunch of different technologies. Transaction bracketing, that is being able to issue the start, commit, and abort operations. Deciding which work gets partitioned between the workflow controller and the transaction servers. In the project, there's not much distinction really between the resource manager and the transaction server. It's not like you've got this big heavyweight database system and then a stateless application program that's talking to the database system. It's more like the resource manager and the application are kind of tied together as one thing. But partitioning work between the workflow controller and that other layer is an issue that you face in adding that layer. You have to propagate transaction context and resource manager calls, which should be clear from the interface. And you've got to decide where to route each request. So when you're accessing a resource, you've got to know which resource to access. And you could even scale it beyond that, where you might have multiple resource managers handling a particular resource in order to partition it up to be able to spread it out over more machines or reduce a locking bottleneck potentially. So I'm going to cover these topics later. Probably a week from Thursday is the current plan. And I'll try to stick to that. But if you're chugging along and really want to know this stuff, this is all covered in chapters 2 and 3 of the text, which you now have. Steps 6 through 10 involve two-phase commit, and I plan to cover it by April 30th, and it's all laid out in detail in Chapter 8, which I also handed out today. Chapter 8 is not much changed from the last edition of the textbook. It needs to be. It needs to be updated. It's one of the chapters that I have not really had a chance to do a complete refresh on, especially compared to the others. Chapters 2 and 3 only bear a passing resemblance to the first edition. They're quite different. But I did make a pass over it, at least to correct some of the obvious things that are now different in the industry. But it will, if you compare it to the published book, you'll find it's almost the same. And then finally, process structure. For architectural reasons, the resource manager and workflow controller ought to be separate processes, so that they can be at least put on separate machines, which is commonly the case. Ordinarily, there's one transaction manager process per computer, per operating system image, if you will. And to simulate this, you know, a transaction manager should also be a process. I think this starts on step 6, I guess. I don't think it's any earlier than that. But so these are just guidelines. They're not in the project description, so I thought I would just outline them here just to give you an opportunity to push ahead more quickly if you want to. Are there any questions on any of this? Nope. Okay. So the topic for tonight, for the rest of tonight, is database system recovery, which is chapter 7 of the textbook. We're not going to get through it all tonight, but chapter 7 of the textbook covers more than database system recovery. The early parts talk about system recovery in general. I'll talk a little bit about that, but I'm going to postpone that till later because I want to get into the actual recovery algorithms. And so we have the outline, which I'm not sure I'm covering 3, actually. I'm not sure this is... We'll see. I'm not sure the outline actually is consistent with what I'm talking tonight, but there might not be a section 3 there. We'll see. So, start from first principles. The database may become inconsistent either because a transaction aborts, in which case it may have updated data on the disk, and we got a problem. Now, database is not consistent. Or the database system fails. For example, the operating system crashes while the database system is processing transactions, and therefore it's going to be, it could be in any kind of arbitrary state. Who knows what's on the disk? And when it recovers, it's going to be in a very funny, very strange state. Or you could have a media failure where the data, the storage device, which is supposedly stable and resistant to failure, has failed. You have a disk failure. It's no longer readable, or a block of the disk is no longer readable. Or it can fail in multiple other ways. So what we need is a recovery system that can handle all of these with actually with arbitrarily high probability it will handle all of these sorts of errors. And so what we're going to do is going to walk through very systematically how to think about this to come up with an algorithms that have this property. Now, we already did this twice actually. We did it once on the first assignment for a very simple system, and then we did it again with shadowing. Now we're going to do it for real, all right, and try to cover all the steps and try not to leave anything out. So the goal of the recovery system, or the database recovery system at least, is to ensure the database contains exactly the set of updates produced by committed transactions and no others. In other words, we're going to get the atomicity and durability properties despite failures. So, we're going to start out with some assumptions. The first one is we're going to stick to. The second one is just for a while. So the first assumption is that we're going to use two-phase locking with transactions are going to hold their write locks until after the transaction commits. All right, this is strictness. Right. So this implies recoverability. That means we can always abort a transaction without breaking the definition of transaction. That is that by aborting a transaction, we're not going to invalidate the read of an already committed transaction. There'll be no cascading aborts. So if we abort a transaction, we can do it in isolation. We don't have to worry about aborting any other transactions. And we can undo updates by restoring before images. That's what strictness gives us. Right. In addition, we're going to assume page level everything for now. That is to say, page level locks, page level I/O, page level everything, reads and writes, everything is a full page. This is not how systems work, and we will weaken the assumption after a while. But it's hard enough to get through the abstractions with this assumption, which definitely simplifies things quite a bit. So page grain locks, reads and read and write operations operate on pages. The database is a set of pages. There's no concept of record, which is some shorter unit of storage that sits within a page. That's just not supported for a while. Okay? Now for the storage model. So the storage, the model here is to reflect the way computers really work, and we're going to therefore distinguish between a stable storage area, which is today a disk drive, relatively stable, which is to say that it survives operating system failures and power failures, usually. And main memory, which is volatile. Right. So the assumption for now is that we're going to have two kinds of information on stable storage. And one is a stable database, a copy of all the database pages. And the other is auxiliary information, like a log or maybe shadow pages if we were using shadow paging, some auxiliary information. It's not part of the database, but it's information the recovery system needs in stable storage so that after the system recovers from a failure where it lost all of main memory, in other words, an operating system crash or even a disk crash where you've got other disks around, that you've got extra information that the recovery system is going to use in order to get the stable database back into shape so that it contains only the committed updates. Right? So I'll call that the log. It usually is a log, but there are other algorithms that don't involve logging. And then in addition, there's a cache. And the cache is just a buffer that contains some of the pages that have been accessed recently. The cache manager supports five operations. We're going to go through them in some detail, but I'll do them once now. The fetch operation, let's see here. The fetch operation brings a page from the stable database and puts it into the cache. Right? The flush operation does the opposite. It takes an updated page from the cache and flushes it back out into the database. The pin operation makes a page in the cache unavailable for flushing. And the unpin operation does the opposite, just like a lock, if you will. It releases it. And then deallocate just throws out a cache page, just makes it available. Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. There'll be a pin count. So, but first let's talk about the operations on stable storage, notably the write operation. Now we're really counting this write operation of a page into stable storage is very important because it's the only operation we have that's atomic with respect to failures. You know, we're counting on the fact that if you write a page to disk, either the page has been overwritten or it hasn't, that there's no other state. Well, there might be one other state where you overwrote it and it failed while the write was happening, and when you read it back, you'll get an error indicating that the write, whatever the last write was, had corrupted the page. Now, that's quite a bit different than saying that the write operation is all or nothing. Right? It says it's either all or it corrupted the page and it'll tell you about it, or it did nothing. Right? So you have to know how the disk behaves. You've probably never looked carefully to understand exactly what the failure properties are of disks, but they're documented, you know, and sometimes the documentation is true. But often it isn't, or at least it's not clear, or it's much weaker than you ever imagined. So if you think about it, this at the hardware level, part of what's going on is just how much in the way of error detection is going on in this path. You know, if you think about the hardware, you've got a cache memory, and first of all, hopefully there's at least parity bits on the cache. Now, if you're running some cheap PC, probably there aren't any parity bits on the cache. That's one of the many ways they cut corners. Hopefully, if you've got a robust server, you know, part of what you paid extra for is that it's got at least one parity bit on every word, and hopefully, you know, some more robust systems even more than that. Then when you issue a write operation to copy a page from memory into the disk controller, there are wires that connect. There's a whole path of wires, in effect, that connect the main memory to the disk controller. You know, there's many ways the computer can be put together, but, you know, the memory may plug into a bus, and the bus has a path to the disk controller. The disk controller plugs in, and really, when you issue that write operation, you know, you're giving a command. First, you're sending a command across the bus to the disk controller, and then it's coming back and doing a direct memory access to the memory and pulling the data into the disk controller's local memory. And then from there, it's writing the data from the disk controller's local memory to the disk. So there's lots of stuff moving around, and they're all connected by wires. And on a robust system, they've got error detecting codes and checksums and all kinds of stuff on all of those paths. And on a cheap computer, they don't. Yeah?
So it's impossible for the disk controller to know whether it read the data in memory successfully, because it isn't as though there's a checksum in memory that is created in memory before the stuff is read.
There,
the disk controller.
Well, that's an interesting question. So the observation is you got a page in memory, and especially if there's no parity bits on the memory, but in any case, when there's no hardware checksum on the page in memory, and so when that page moves to the disk controller, something bad might happen, and the disk controller, there's no checksum on the page. So there's no way the disk controller can inexpensively determine that the page that it's received is the same as the page that it copied from main memory. So, you know, this is like, how hard do you want to work? You know, you could have the data manager, the database system, put a checksum on every page, you know, and pay the price so that the controller won't know, but when the page is ultimately read back off the disk, the database system could actually double, you know, check the checksum, right? But yes, you know, this is the level at which you have to think. It's just sort of where all this stuff is being done and how hard you're going to work. The reason why I'm going to talk a lot about, I'm talking a lot about this slide is that after we're done, I'm just going to forget about it, basically, because there's a whole set of things that can go wrong, in other words, and you know, you've just identified one of them, but there are many others. Like, you could write the page correct. The disk controller could correctly write the page to the incorrect location, and it's easy to imagine how this would happen. That the hardware has a has parity bits on the data content, but not on the address line. Right? You know, I mean, there's a bunch of wires connecting it, you know, and some of the wires are moving data, and some of the wires are moving address. And the wires that are moving address do not have parity on them. And so they could easily get corrupted. And that would cause the page to go to a different location, different address on the disk. Why not? You know, I mean, if it's not protected, it can happen. And even if it is protected, it can happen, although it's much lower probability, because it would take a double point failure compensating errors in order for it to happen, which is much less likely. This stuff happens. You know, I mean, I've heard stories. I know people who have discovered this, you know, that someone once told me a story about a database, and they had a corrupted data. They had lost an update. You know, they were sure that the transaction had committed, and then later on the customer complained. They went and looked at the data. The customer was right. The data in the database was wrong. They had no idea what happened. They went and fixed it. And a while later, months, a year, I don't know, they had trouble with the disk, and they dumped the disk. And they were looking at certain pages because this is where, you know, whatever problem they were having with the disk. And it so happened the person who was looking to debug this problem remembered this problem they had had from whatever it was a year earlier, and lo and behold, found the customer's data somewhere else on the disk drive. You know, what are the odds, you know, that you would even ever see it? But this stuff obviously can happen. Now, when you buy an integrated hardware-software solution, you know, and it comes, you know, certified, you know, this is a Microsoft-certified system on which to run SQL Server. Not that Microsoft is the only one doing it, but I mean, this concept is someone's taken the trouble to look at all this stuff, you know. And it's like the work that's in the recovery manager is known to be making the right assumptions relative to the disk drives and disk controllers that are hooked up to this system. It's, you know, it's safe for enterprise data, or safer than if you just simply go out and start buying hardware piecemeal. And yeah, you can get the software to run, and it'll probably run, but how sure are you that you're going to get the level of reliability that you really intended? So it's, you know, part of what you pay for, and it's hard to explain. You know, it's sort of the difference between industrial strength and not, like a lot of things. All right, so in short, there's a lot of interesting complexity going on at this interface, but from now on we're going to assume that writing to the disk is an all or nothing operation. And just remember that there's a whole layer of software there that has a lot of work to do to make that true, including reading stuff back, and, you know, just how hard do you want to work in order to make that true? Okay? So, next is the cache. The cache is divided into page-sized slots. And so when you fetch a page from the disk, you're putting it into a slot in the cache. So you need some kind of a descriptor that the cache manager is going to use in order to keep track of what's in all these page slots. Right? So it's going to have, for each page in the cache, it's going to have, first of all, a page address. This is the identity of the page, typically the disk address of the page, the cache address where it's located, and then a bit that indicates whether the page has been updated since the last time it was written to disk. All right, so when you fetch a page from the disk into cache, the dirty bit is zero. And whenever someone updates the page, they've got to set that dirty bit to 1. And when the page is flushed back out to disk, you clear the bit again afterwards to indicate that the page is clean in memory. The pin count is the number of pin operations that have been accessed minus the number of unpin operations that have been executed. In other words, it's essentially any application program that's accessing that page, that cache slot, I guess is the way to say it, that's accessing that cache slot, has done a pin operation, because you don't want that page to be flushed and replaced out from under you. In particular, if you're writing into that page, then it would be terrible to have that page flushed, because here you are, you've got this application program which is writing into the page, you know, byte by byte, and then independently the disk controller is going to suck that page into its controller in order to write it out to disk, which is how it works. The disk controller has direct access to memory to do this. And so it could be getting any random state of the page if the page is in the midst of being updated while it's also being flushed. So you don't ever want that to happen. So the pin count is the number of clients that are updating or at least accessing the page. So the flush operation flushes the page if the page slot is dirty and it's unpinned. So you want basically a 1 for the dirty bit and a 0 for the pin count. So currently that's the only page that can currently be flushed. You don't want to flush the other two because there's a non-zero pin count. And you wouldn't want to flush this one anyway because it has a 0 dirty bit. There's no reason to flush it because the disk is the same as the cache. The flush operation returns after the disk acknowledges that the flush operation is executed. So this is important because higher levels of software, when the flush operations returns, they're going to take that to mean that the data is on the disk. So they want to know that the disk has acknowledged. Now, this requires, you know, some disk driver level programming, because the flush operation will issue the I/O to cause the write to happen, but it's going to get an asynchronous acknowledgement after the write operation is completed. You know, and then we get back to this question of, well, how hard is it going to work to find out whether it's really true? I mean, it's nice that it got the acknowledgement, but is the data really on disk? Did something go wrong? Well, probably the only way to know is to read it back, although even that's not foolproof. But it's very costly, and nobody does it, you know, at least unless you're really into some ultra-high reliability such scenarios. Yeah?
How does the dirty bit get set?
So how does the dirty bit get set? Well, there are a couple of ways, but that brings me to the next slide. It could get set by the unpin operation. It could be the assumption is, or it could be a parameter to the unpin operation. And that would be the logical way to do it. Or it could be a separate operation, you know, make dirty. But you know, probably so we could say it's unpin releases the pin, and optionally sets dirty equal to 1. The metaphor here is that a page is a piece of paper, right? And it's in the cache, and you're driving a pin to hold it down so it doesn't blow away. And then when you unpin, you're pulling out the pin, allowing it to move back. Sometimes this is called fixing and unfixing the page in some systems. I think pin is a nicer term for it. Okay, and deallocating a page allows the cache slot to be reused. So, and even if it's dirty. If it's dirty, that means you believe that whatever was there is useless. Yeah, you go.
What happens if I try to pin a page that's been flushed?
To pin a page if it's been flushed.
Is it possible?
Yeah, sure. So you want to pin a page that's already been flushed. Pinning a page just means that you're planning to update it. You can update it. I mean, in fact, popular pages will remain in cache for very long periods, but even though they're very popular, that is, they're being accessed frequently, you must periodically write them out to disk just for reliability reasons. And so, after it's been written to disk, it still is a frequently accessed page, will remain in cache, and now transactions will start updating it again. Sorry? While it's being flushed. Right, so the flush operation has to block any pin operations. I think that's what you're getting at, yes. So, okay, that's a very good point. I should have mentioned that too. I'm sorry, I got this backwards now. Flush. Prevents concurrent pins. When you start to flush, you don't want anybody to pin, because once you allow them to pin, you're giving them permission to starting to write, and that's what you don't want to allow. Programming at this level is very delicate. It's not a lot of code, but you got to get things in exactly the right order or bad things happen. And also you have to remember, you're sort of in the inner loop of the system. So actions like reading and writing pages are happening at a very high rate. So if there's any bad sequences that could cause trouble, there's a very high probability that they'll actually happen, because you've got lots of concurrent activity and it's going very fast. Yeah?
So, what's the slot on the pin?
Sorry? When the slot has been deallocated, it's free to be reused. And yes. If the pin count is zero and it's not dirty, then it's available to be reused, depending on the page replacement strategy. Because, so the way this is going to work is that when an application wants to access a page, it does a fetch. And the way a fetch is serviced is that the cache manager looks in its descriptor table, which is a hash table on page address, and it looks up that page address and sees whether it's in the cache. If it is, great. And usually it's fetch. Some systems actually make fetch and pin a single operation, or at least one variant. You know, you fetch and pin in one operation. And it just returns then the address of the cache slot, giving higher layers of software direct access into that page. As long as it's not pinned and not dirty, if a fetch arrives, well, back up. If a fetch arrives for a page that's not in the cache, then of course the cache manager has to find a place to put it. And the eligible pages are either ones that have been deallocated or pages that are not dirty and have a zero pin count. Those are the only ones that are available to be reused. And so you can start thinking through what the sequence of operations are there, you know, to make sure, because there's a lot of other activity, just what has to be locked in the way of control structures to make the fetch operation atomic with respect to pin operations. Right? One transaction is in there trying to fetch a page, another one's trying to pin the page that's in the cache slot, which is going to be the destination for this new page that's about to be brought into cache. Right? You got cache slot 1 contains page 7. But it's clean and zero pin count. Right? So one transaction is trying to pin the page, but another transaction is trying to fetch page 26. And the cache manager has decided that cache slot 1 is an eligible place to put it. And so now you got to make sure that they don't both use that cache slot for different pages, that one of them pins and the other one uses it to be overwritten for page 26 in the same cache slot. Okay. So I gave you a high-level view of what a database system architecture looks like last time. Let me review it now with this cache manager picture in mind. So recall that we have a query that comes in from the top. It's, for example, a SQL query, and it gets compiled into some it's called a query plan, which is basically a directed acyclic graph of operators that are going to be executed and move data between them. And those operators are going to read and write records. That's access methods. They're going to read and write record-oriented files, which are in turn, in order to read and write records inside the pages, they're going to have the access methods are going to have to read and write pages, which are page-oriented files. So we're down here, basically. This whole discussion is happening down here at the level of page-oriented files. You are here. Right. And the interface to this whole layer is this fetch, flush, pin, unpin, deallocate. Okay? That's the picture. We're going to get into this more as we go on, but that's, and it's got three layers. At the bottom layer is the page file manager, which knows how to map page addresses to disk locations. That's sitting underneath the cache manager. Because when the cache manager says to read page 14 of file F, then that has to be mapped to a disk address somewhere. It could be above or below, I guess. It doesn't really matter. It depends on how the cache manager is addressing pages. The cache manager, we've already talked about, and then the recovery manager has yet to really appear, but it's going to handle aborts and recoveries from system failures. Okay, so some more structures we have to look at. So a latch is a short-term lock that gives its owner access to a page. Now this is different than a pin. All right, so I've been sort of stammering a little bit answering some of your questions because I didn't really want to try to get this out in the right order about locking a page while it's being flushed and all. But a latch is basically a short-term lock that gives its owner access to the page. A read latch allows the owner to read the content. A write latch allows the owner to modify the content. And with the obvious semantics, usually you can only have one write latch on a page at a time. You can have any number of read latches. And the latches are different than the pin counts. Pinning the page prevents it from being flushed. Latches are really giving you the, exclusive access. You're saying, I am in the page actually working on it. They are locks. But they're a bit in a control structure associated with the page. They're not in the lock manager. It's not a separate thing. It can be, it's really a bit. It can be set and released much faster than a lock. There's no transaction ID associated with it. There's no deadlock detection. It's just, you know, set a latch, release a latch. So this is going to be used by fairly low layers in the data manager very carefully. Right? I mean, if you deadlock on latches, that's it. I mean, reboot. There's nothing you can do. I mean, you must not, and there are very strict rules on latching pages. Like, you know, you don't ever hold two write latches. I mean, there's very, you know, in code where you really get into code that has to set more than one latch gets read by a lot of people. You know, because it's hard to debug. I mean, all you can really do is just make sure there are no windows. There's no way that something bad can happen. All right, so we're going to, one more topic, and then we'll actually look at how all these pieces fit together. We have a log. Log is a sequential file of records that describe updates to pages. So it includes the address of the page. Each log record includes the address of the page that's been updated, the identifier of the transaction that did the update, and a before image and after image of the data that was just updated, in this case a page. I mean, this is very big. This is a consequence of our page granularity everything assumption, which we'll dispose of later. But so at this point, a record in the log is two pages plus a little bit. Right? Before image of the page, after image of the page, that is before the value of the page before and after the update, as well as the transaction ID and of course the address of the page. The name of the page. Now, whenever you update a page in cache, you have to write a log record to indicate what you did. That's what the log is. The log is going to be a history of everything that's been done to the database. So, in addition, the log is going to have records that indicate the transaction has committed or aborted. Now, we're going to assume that all of this is happening on one log. That is, the log's got all the update records as well as the commit records and the abort records. It's not always done that way. Some older systems, in particular, separated before images from after images. Some systems do this separation after the log's already been written. They split it up later on for recovering from disk failures, which I won't get to tonight, but there's a lot of reasons for splitting it up. But I'm just going to assume it's all together, which is in one big file, which is the way it's usually done. Now, the recovery manager, this log is basically for the benefit of the recovery manager. Because if the system fails and then recovers, the log is going to be where it looks to figure out what was going on in the system at the moment of failure. So, in particular, it's going to assume that the order in which writes have been performed on the log accurately reflects the order in which writes have been done to the database. Or said differently, if I've got two write operations to the same page, it's going to assume that the order of the writes in the log are exactly the order in which the writes were applied to the page. It better be true, otherwise how else would it know at recovery time what the final value of the page ought to be? Yeah? Does it mean you would update the log on every flush? No, you actually update it more often than that. You update it, you add a record to the log every time you write into the page. Right, even in the cache. Every time you update the page in the cache, you must update the log.
And the log is in a non-volatile system.
The log will ultimately be in be on disk. It will ultimately be in non-volatile storage. Of course, like any file, I mean, it has cache also, so you're writing it to the end of the log in main memory, and eventually that portion of the log goes out to disk sequentially. very carefully, as we'll see, because in particular, if it didn't go out sequentially, we'd be back with this assumption would be questionable. Yep.
We are not changing the contents of the cache on every write operation. We're changing the contents of the cache on every commit operation.
We're not changing the contents of the cache on every write operation?
So if an application is going to say, modify this record to say three items left in the warehouse, now commit.
Yeah.
Presumably, the cache is only getting updated once.
Ah, big assumption. No, that's actually not true. Most systems. I understand what you're doing. So the suggestion is, this is a suggested execution strategy, which is that as the transaction is executing, you accumulate its updates. You don't actually apply them to the pages in cache. Because after all, the page might get flushed and the transaction hasn't committed yet. So this doesn't sound too good, right? So what he's suggesting is maybe we ought to hold on to the updates for a while and then write them. And when the transaction says, I'm ready to commit, now we'll update the cache and also update the log. And as we'll see, that certainly is one way to do things. It may be even a sensible way to do things in your projects and in some systems, but it's actually not the way things are usually done. For a wide variety of reasons that I'll get to. That usually updates are applied to the cache at the moment that the writes happen.
So you assume that aborts are rare.
Well, you know, writing into the cache is not a, undoing an update in cache is not expensive. So even if aborts were frequent, undoing the update in the cache might not be too bad. The bad situation is that the updated page in the cache has gone out to disk. And the transaction is aborted. Now that's expensive. Now you got to go out to the first. You got to find it, and then you got to go out to the disk and restore the value of that page to be the value it had before the aborted transaction ran. That's what the log is for. Yeah.
So how much more bookkeeping do you need to figure out entries in the log that must be removed if a transaction aborts?
Ah. So the question is, how much bookkeeping is required in order to get rid of records from the log of aborted transactions? You never get rid of records from the log of aborted transactions. The log is a sequential file. You write to the end. You keep writing. I mean, after all, I mean, given everything you just heard about disk drives, I mean, would you really want to go in and modify a page of the log, you know, like in the middle of the log, and have it corrupt the page, and now have the log corrupted and the database in the wrong state? I mean, you're now totally wiped out, right? Unrecoverable error. Because you never go back and fix up the log that way. The log is indelible. It's an append-only file.
So if you write an abort for a transaction, how do you figure out how far back to go?
Right. So if you add an abort record for a transaction, how do you figure out how far back to go? Right. That's why this is a long chapter. I'm not going to answer that now. I'll answer it at the right time. But it's a very good question. That's when the algorithms are complicated, as you'll see. Yeah.
It's related to what you were saying, that you are just going to append. It seems to me like you also want to remove very old data, otherwise you would need like infinite amount of storage.
Right. So. The observation is you probably want to do more than append. You want to truncate. You want to get rid of the prefix of the log periodically because you don't want to have... First of all, you're going to run out of disk space eventually. And second of all is that how much log do you really want to have to process at recovery time? It could take a while. Not a good thing. Right. That's, you're going to want to checkpoint the log. Absolutely. Okay, we've been going for an hour. Let's stop here. Take a break. Okay, the next slide is the real picture here. So this will answer a bunch of this. Now will finally answer questions that came up along the way. Application or access method code really. Wants to update a record on a page, wants to update the page. How does it do it? Well, first it's got to fetch the page to get it into cache, and then pin it to make sure that it isn't flushed while it's about to do its update. Then it has to set a write lock on the page before it does the update, or then it's on the record, but on the page for now. Then it has to set a write latch on the page to get exclusive access to the page. So, because you don't want anybody else updating the page while you're updating the page. Then you update the page and you log the update. And then you unlatch the page, indicating that you're no longer updating it. You release the write latch. And then you can unpin it. All right. Questions? Yeah. Why would you want to get exclusive access to P? Well, because you're updating. When, you know, in updating the page, you're moving bits around the page. It's not just updating a particular region. I mean, you might have to be updating the header, and you know, maybe it's a a variable length record, and so. Maybe you have, you know, maybe there's not enough space and you have to move it around. I mean, the simple thing is just lock the page. You know, it doesn't take that long to update the bits on the page and then unlock it.
But the locking, like two-phase locking, is different. Happening at a higher level.
Yeah. So remember, let's try to put some pieces together. The last couple of weeks we've been drawing these histories, you know, read X, write Y, read. And every now and then I say, and remember, these are atomic operations. That's why it's okay to reason about these sequences of operations. You know, that you can think of, you know, first write Z and then read Z and all, right? Latching makes that true. Latching makes that true because in order to write Z, you've got a first, you get a write lock on Z. That's in order to get the transactions to be serializable. But then you get a write latch on the page of Z. That's to make sure that the write operations are serializable. See, there's like two levels of serialization going on here. I mean, as you all know, I mean, writing into Z, writing into the page, that's not an atomic operation. I mean, you know how computers work, you know, it's write the first word, write the second word, write the third word. Right? I mean, it's just plain not atomic. If you want to make that atomic, you're going to have some synchronization. And so the abstraction is you want to make reads and writes on that page serializable with respect to each other, which is simply to say that reads and writes are atomic. So read latches and write latches are exactly that.
The question.
Yeah.
Which operation here prevents another transaction from pinning the page?
There are no operations that prevent another transaction from pinning a page. So
how do you prevent?
Well, I mean, the latches are going to prevent anything bad from happening. If you try to pin the page and the page is latched because it's currently being flushed, I guess it's really a matter of design. I mean, you could either allow the pin and just trust the fact that the transaction that received the pin is not going to be able to do anything with it, because they're going to latch, or you could just delay the pin until the flush is completed, which would be more in tune with the semantics of never flush a page when its pin count is non-zero. So you would just delay the cache manager knows whether or not the page is being flushed, and so when the pin operation comes in, it can just delay it until the flush is complete. Okay?
So if the two-phase locking, if the granularity that it operated on was always at the page level, would you
still need this added semantics of latching on top of that?
Yeah, so the question is, if you were using page-level locking, really, you know, two-phase locking was page-level, would you still need to latch pages? Anybody? I guess not. I just thought about it. I mean, you would need to read latch pages, I guess, but I'm not sure about right latching.
So it looks like right lock and right.
Yeah,
latch.
Yeah. And once you've right latched the page, once you've right locked the page, that's it. You're not going to get any. No other transaction is going to be able to get into the page. So that's true. You're right. I'm not thinking clearly. If you do page level locking, then the latching is not going to be helpful. But if you do finer grain locking, then the latching is essential. Good point. Yes.
At what point are we releasing the right lock here?
At what point are we releasing the right lock? Answer? Two-phase locking, right? So strict two-phase locking. We're holding on to write locks until after the commit, holding on to read locks until at least before the commit.
So the write locker that you're describing here is not within the cache manager.
No, this is
manager.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. This is the plain old two-phase locking lock manager. So you got to be a little bit careful about this. For example, you would not want to unlatch the page before logging the update. Why?
Because someone else could instantaneously grab a latch, act on that data, and change. Right, and then the log can try to come in.
You're close. You're almost. You're in the right. The right.
Can you repeat
that, please?
Right, and then when you're flushing.
Got to do with the log. The log records at the end. Right. Okay. So we got this. So the issue is.
We're getting some terrible cell phone noise over here.
Cell phone noise?
Yeah.
Who's got their cell phone on? I'm pretty sure mine is off. Not me. Is it affecting me, too?
We couldn't hear anything for a moment there.
Well, yeah, the students were all trying to answer the question, but none of them were speaking up very loud. All right, so the question is, why move? What happens if we move the latch earlier, the unlatch earlier? And the answer is that you could have two write operations that write in the page, but have their log records be in the opposite order. So you could have a write one into the page, and then it unlatches the latch, and at this point it just delays for a moment. Now it's unlatched the page, and so in principle, you know, write lock notwithstanding, you could come in and do a second write, maybe even from the same transaction. You could do a second write. The second write would get the write latch on the page, update the page, and then log the update before write one logs its update, even within the same transaction, even though they both have the page locked. And now the updates in the log would be in the opposite order of the updates that were applied to the page. It's instructive, just sort of as an exercise, to go through this and ask yourself, what happens if I just try to permute the order of these operations? Just pick two of them. Just kind of walk through. Yeah.
Does the commit of transaction cause the page to be flushed?
Does a commit of a transaction force its pages to be flushed?
Yeah.
No. Well, I should say maybe. It really depends on the algorithm. Now, we'll get to that in a second, but clearly, if commit means anything at all, it means that the updates are durable. So one way or another, the updates have to be on the disk. If not in the stable database, then in the log, one place or the other. But we're going to go through a whole bunch of rules about this. All right, so now we can actually talk about commit and abort. So the recovery manager is the layer that processes commit, abort, and restart. Commit, you know what these operations do. Commit writes the transaction's updated page to stable storage atomically, even with respect to system failures. Abort, and you know at least one way to do that using shadow paging, but we're going to do it with, shall I say, more practical algorithms. Abort undoes the effects of a transaction's writes. And restart recovers from the failure of the operating system or database system or both. It aborts all transactions that were not committed at the time of the previous failure. It completes the abort of any transaction that was in the midst of aborting at the time of the previous failure. And it ensures that all of the committed transactions, that their updates really are in the database if they committed, so that the database has all committed updates and no uncommitted ones. That's the goal. Or it gives the illusion to subsequent transactions that the database contains all committed updates and no uncommitted ones. Now, obviously, it doesn't have to be, the disk doesn't actually have to be in that state in order for the recovery manager to give that illusion to new transactions that start running. For example, some of the recovered data might be in the cache, and it will make it out to the stable database, but right now it's still only in the cache. It's in the log, so even if you fail again, it will know what to do to fix things up, but it can give you the illusion that the database contains all committed updates and no uncommitted ones. So here's the picture. This is a modification of the picture I already showed you. So you've got the stable database and the log. This is stable storage. And you've got the cache. And the cache manager needs to read and write the stable database and the cache in order to process fetch and flush operations. Right? It's got to move data back and forth between the cache and the stable database to do fetches and flushes. And in addition, application programs, or at least higher layers of the database system, may also read and write the cache. Because if the application has fetched the page, pinned the page, locked the page, and latched the page, it can directly access main memory. It can directly access the page. Which, of course, is a good thing. I don't know if you're in the inner loop. Main memory, copying data back and forth between the cache and the application, is a relatively expensive thing to do in the inner loop of a system. And so you really want to give direct access to the page, maybe not to any old program, but at least to like lower layers of the database system, which have been thoroughly tested, because you really want them to run fast. Okay. And then the cache manager also does pin and unpin, which we talked about, and deallocate. And then finally, commit and abort are coming in from the top. Commit and abort, of course, are being issued by transactions, and restart is being, well, it's the same thing as booting up the database, isn't it? You know, that when you recover from a failure, you tell the database system to start up, and unless it's in a totally clean state, which means you just installed it, you installed the product, you installed the database, you know, it's a complete virgin system, then any other time you boot it up, it's going to run recovery. Because it can't be sure, unless you did a very smooth shutdown the previous time and gave it the opportunity, and even then, it still has to open up the log and recognize the fact that it did a smooth shutdown the last time. So there's always something to do. Okay. So we're going to now talk about implementing commit and abort and what rules these operations imply. So to implement abort, suppose a transaction wrote a page, P. P was not transferred to stable storage, and the transaction aborts. Great. The page is in memory. Transaction aborts. Deallocate the page. Forget it, right? Just make believe. You know, you don't have the before image necessarily in the cache, so you might as well just deallocate it. Now, suppose that the page was transferred to the stable database before the transaction aborts. Well, remember that an abort might happen as a result of a restart, right? So the sequence of events could be the transaction's updated page in the cache went to stable database, and then the system went down. The operating system crashed. So now when the database system comes back up and it restarts, it has to restore, it has to abort this transaction, which was in the midst of executing at the time of the failure. And to abort it, it needs to restore the before image of that page that it wrote into the database. The only hope of doing that is if the before image is in the log. If the before image isn't in the log, you can't recover. So, the undo rule says, do not flush an uncommitted update of a page until the page's before image is stable, usually in the log. But it could be somewhere else. And basically, the reason I call this the undo rule is it's the rule that makes sure undo is possible. And there's something called the write-ahead log protocol, or just sometimes called the write-ahead protocol. And what the write-ahead log protocol says is, do not flush an uncommitted update of a page P until the page's before image is in the log. So, now we're assuming we're doing logging now. Basically, the write-ahead log protocol is the implementation of the undo rule when you're using logging, because that's the only place you can put the before image. All right. Okay, so the question is, if you transfer the uncommitted update to stable storage, what makes you so sure that no transaction is going to read the uncommitted data? All right, so two possibilities. First possibility is there are no failures. All right. In that case, the transaction that wrote this page has a write lock on the page. No one can get a read lock on the page. Therefore, no one's going to read the page until the transaction commits. And at that point, it's okay to release the lock. Case two is recovering from system failure. And we've got this bad page on the disk. And I guess my advice to you is wait till restart finishes doing its work before you let anybody do any reading. Now, we're going to do better than that, right? But for now, that's sort of the simple, crude answer to the question. There are cleverer answers. But whatever the clever answer is, it still better amount to the fact that nobody reads that page till it's been recovered. Whoops. Yeah, okay. So, you can avoid undo. It's very easy. In fact, it was already suggested how. That is, you just never flush an uncommitted update to the database, right? That was your suggestion earlier. And if you never flush an uncommitted update to the stable database, then you never have to put a before image in the log. Because what could you possibly use it for? Right? If a transaction aborts, its updates are all in cache. Where else could they be? You're not allowed to flush them to the database. And even if you put the after images in the log, what difference does it make? You're not going to apply them because you're going to just abort the transaction. So there's really no need to write before images to the log. In fact, you never have to undo. You never have to undo updates to the stable database. So stated in the opposite way, we'll say that a recovery algorithm requires undo if an update of an uncommitted transaction can be flushed. I mean, I've got these long pauses because I know it. I'm slowing down a little bit because I want you to. You have to think about almost every line here in order to kind of absorb what's going on.
This seems like it would be kind of impractical for long-running transactions. Couldn't you get in a situation where you run out of memory?
Yeah. So you mean avoiding undo?
Right.
Yeah, avoiding undo is a problem with long-running transactions because all the updates have to be cached.
Right.
Well, they don't have to be. I mean, if you have too many, you could put them in the log, but then when the transaction commits, you got to go back to the log to get them in order to apply them to the database. That doesn't sound so great. But if you had a system where you knew you had a relatively large amount of main memory and you were running transactions at a very high rate and all your transactions are short by design, this is a system designed only for short transactions, might actually work out okay. And there actually are products that have been built this way. It has one nice advantage, which is the log is shorter. So you can write to the log faster because there's less stuff to write. You don't have to write before images. So it's not completely impractical, but it's definitely, you're making some assumptions about the transaction load when you if you adopt that approach.
Don't you still run into a problem trying to make the commits seem atomic in that case, though? Because it seems like you can have all these dirty pages in the cache, and then when it comes time to actually commit, flushing all those to disk, at that point you can fail at any time in that process, and you have some pages on disk and some pages aren't. Like, don't you still end up with this problem of having some pages that are on disk that aren't actually really there?
Okay, so the question is, if you adopt this approach of avoiding undo, and so you don't apply the updates of a transaction to the database until after it commits, then what happens if there's a failure while you're processing the updates? And the answer is, when you recover, you better be able to apply the updates to the database. We'll get to that. That's the other rule. That's the commit rule. Right? There's two sides to this coin. There's, you'll see in a second, but we can play this game on the other side, which is to say, if we put all the updates in the database before we commit, then we'll never have to redo. Right? Okay. So an algorithm that requires undo is usually called a steal algorithm because it allows a dirty cache page to be stolen. I find this not very intuitive relative to I don't like to emphasize it, but it's one of those concepts that came up in a very early paper on recovery systems based on certain assumptions about how the cache manager behaves, and they were trying to come up with explanations for why you would do certain things. And they observed that a steal algorithm is one where you're going to have to undo. Why is it steal? Why that? Well, because if you've got a dirty page in cache and you've got to reuse that page for some other purpose, like you might overflow, then you're going to have to write that dirty page to the database in order to steal its cache slot. All right, so that's why it's called a steal algorithm. It's of more than historical interest because if you read books on database recovery, people usually, that's what they usually call it. They don't call it requiring undo. They call it steal. All right, so I sort of previewed this a moment ago in answer to the last question, but implementing commit. Commit has to be atomic, so it's got to be implemented by a single disk write. And now, so suppose a transaction wrote a page, P, it committed, and then the system failed. Well, since transactions are durable, the updated page must be in stable storage. If not in the database, then at least in the log. before the transaction commits. So you don't want to commit a transaction until the after images of all the pages that it wrote are in the stable database, are in stable storage, either the database or the log. If they're in the database, great, then there's nothing you have to do at recovery time. If they're not necessarily in the database, then they're definitely in the log, in which case you might have to redo some of them if the scenario of the last question arises, which is that the transaction was committing, some of its updates made it to the, some of its after images of its updates made it to the stable database, some of them have not gotten there yet. The system fails. When it recovers, the recovery algorithm needs to finish the job because the transaction already committed. Therefore, its updates need to be applied to the stable database. Therefore, they better be in the log because they're not in the database. Where else could they be? This is often called the force at commit rule because if any of the transaction's updates that are in the cache, either they're dirty pages or they're sitting at the tail of the log that has not yet gone out to disk, they've got to be forced out to disk. Now, it doesn't mean that the dirty database pages have to be flushed. It could be that all you're doing is you're just flushing those last few pages of the log that are sitting in memory. You know, after all, you're just adding records to the end of the log. Just because you've appended them to the log doesn't mean that that part of the log is on disk. But before you commit the transaction, you better make sure that all of its after images are on the disk. So this is why it's so important that the log be a sequential file, because the way most logging systems implement commit simply by adding a commit record to the end of the log and then flushing the log. And since the commit record for the transaction has to follow all of the update records for the transaction, if the commit record has made it out to the disk log, then all of the after images of the transaction have made it out as well, because the updates are flowing to the log in sequential order. So this is not just a, well, we'll try our best to have it go out sequentially kind of thing. This is those pages better go out sequentially, or at least you better be able to tell what the last page is in the log that actually contains, such that all of the previous pages are really out there. And it's not enough just to know that the commit record went out to the log. You actually got to know the commit record went out to the log and all the pages before the commit record in the log have gone out to the disk as well, because they may contain some of that transaction's updates, and you don't want to reply to the user that the transaction committed until you know that the data is durable. And you don't know that until the stuff is actually in the log. We're going very deep into disk handshakes here, but this is where the action is. Now, like undo, we can avoid redo. The way to avoid redo is you put all of the transaction's dirty pages into the stable database before the transaction commits. All right, this is usually called a force algorithm because the updates are forced to disk before commit. And in fact, if you look back very early database systems, you know, like early 80s, late 70s, they often used this algorithm because they could understand it. You know, it was like the transaction commits, we know that updates have to be durable, let's put them all in the database, we'll make sure we'll have an undo log, we'll make sure that the write-ahead log protocol is obeyed, and it generates a lot of I.O. You know, these were not fast database systems. There's a lot of I.O. because you got to get all the before images to the log, and then you got to flush all the after images to the database, and then you can commit the transaction. But, you know, in the absence of a well-developed theory and technology for doing recovery, this was at least reliable. You could understand that it was doing the right thing. You were not going to commit transactions and find out that they were not durable. But it is inefficient, especially for hot pages. What's a hot page? A hot page is a page that's being updated frequently. The metaphor is you're updating it a lot, so it's getting hot. And if you're using a force algorithm, then for every transaction that updates that page, you're writing the whole page out to disk. And you might only be updating a little bit of data on the page. So it's really expensive to be writing that page out over and over again when you could potentially be, with a little bit of cleverness about log compression, writing just a little bit of information into the log that explains what the update was that you performed. Not only that, updating the page on the disk is you're moving the disk head to do it, right? Because these are random updates. Whereas the log is a sequential file, you're going at disk bandwidth, forcing the data out to the log. So updates to the log go out much faster than updates to the database. So this is not a fast algorithm, but it works. So a recovery algorithm requires redo if a transaction is allowed to commit before all of its updates are in the stable database. Now, we actually talked about how to avoid both undo and redo. The way you avoid undo is you never flush an uncommitted update to the database. And the way you avoid redo is you flush all of the transactions' updates to the disk before you commit. That's exactly shadow paging. That the commit operation is the operation that puts all the after images, which are already on the disk, into the stable database in one pointer flip. So you're avoiding undo and redo. That's why recovery is no work, other than maybe to clean up a shadow file that you were in the midst of constructing at the time of failure. But other than that, the database is entirely consistent. No logging, no recovery algorithm to speak of. Much easier. It can be done, but it's not so efficient, especially for short transactions and record-level updates. So we've talked about commit, we've talked about abort. I haven't really told you how to do it. I've more given you some requirements, sort of constrained the problem a little bit about the order things go out to the database and go out to the log and just get some of the synchronization rules in place. But I haven't actually given you an algorithm. I have one more rule, which is to implement recovery. Now, we've already talked about what the restart operation has to do. It's got to abort all transactions that were active at the time of the failure, which is to say they were uncommitted at the time of the failure. They were either active or they were in the midst of aborting. And then for every committed transaction, we have to redo updates that are in the log but not in the stable database if we're using an algorithm that requires redo. And then we can resume normal processing because now the database is perfect. It's got all the committed updates and none of the uncommitted ones. There's a word that's going to come up a lot in the rest of this course called idempotent. And an idempotent operation is an operation that you can execute many times and it has the same effect as executing it just once. So in the absence of writes, a read operation is idempotent, for example. Restart has to be idempotent. What do I mean by that? Well, restart is running because the system recently failed. Often there's a reason why it failed. Often that reason is repeatable. So while restart is running, the system might well fail again. So restart has to be very careful while it's recovering to make sure that at every moment in time, the system is always in a restartable state. Right? You know, we've been very careful about doing the commits and aborts and having the right stuff in the logs so that at recovery time we can undo and redo. But now we're going to have to come up with a restart algorithm that actually will undo and redo in the right way. And I'm just observing that whatever it's doing in the way of undo and redo at recovery time, it better be able to cope with the fact that the restart algorithm could fail at any moment. And if it does, when you restart again, the system had better be restartable. So this is a fairly tough constraint. I mean, it means you've got to be very careful about the order in which write operations go out to make sure that the recovery algorithm, you know, that its invariants, if you will, are still satisfied at recovery time. Yes?
I'm surprised that it doesn't say for every uncommitted transaction that modified the database, undo updates that are in the database where the pre-images are in the log.
Well, so you want to restate this first. You want to restate that. It says abort transactions that were active at the time of failure. So the next level of detail is undo all of the updates of transactions that were active at the time of failure, which I think is what you wrote. Not exactly the words, but I think that was the concept. So that's meant to be the same thing. So you want them, they're active. They might have been in the midst of being aborted, but they didn't complete the abort. If they were fully aborted, then of course there's nothing to do. And one more thing. While you're recovering from failure, you're not doing any real work for anybody. As far as the users are concerned, the system is still down while you're running recovery. So recovery needs to be very fast because it's contributing to unavailability. So we've got all these rules for abort and commit. We've got rules for restart. And oh, by the way, this all has to be able to run thousands of transactions per second. And when you recover, you want to recover in, I don't know, some small number of seconds, but certainly a small number of minutes. Seconds would be nice, but certainly, you don't want to take 20 minutes to recover from a failure. That would be very bad. Okay? So, yeah.
Are you going to have a question related to our project? So
project question.
So if we are using like Shandering, so which doesn't require undo and redo, so what do we do for this recovery?
Okay, so the question is, if you've got an in your project, if you're using shadowing, there's no undo or redo. So what does restart really require? So, you know, how do you recover? What do you have to do to recover? And I guess I can't tell you. It sort of depends on how you implement commit and shadowing. But, one thing about shadowing is it does write stuff to disk before the transaction commits. So one dumb approach is you never do anything when you recover from a failure. And every time you fail and then recover, you're going to see more files in your directory of shadows that were in the midst of being created before before each failure. You're never clean anything up. So you never end up reusing now it depends. I mean, maybe that's not how you're doing it. Maybe you're doing something where you're reusing files very carefully and that just isn't going to happen. But I predict that by the time you get to two-phase commit, it will happen. In the first four steps of the project, four or five steps of the project, it won't be much of an issue. It'll be fairly simple. But by the time you get to two-phase commit, you're going to be doing other things. And I predict you will have work to do.
And just now you mentioned the way to avoid redo is commit, just put everything into storage before you say commit. And what if it's crashed between after you put everything into stable storage, then before you actually can record this commit in your log, system crash. So, what?
All right, so I mean, recount the scenario. So transaction is in the midst of committing, all of its updates have been written to the disk, but it hasn't actually committed, so it hasn't actually written to the root page, for example, to swap files. And now the system fails. So the transaction aborts. When you recover, you've lost all of main memory, right? You've lost all of main memory, and the transaction didn't commit, so it aborts. The updates never find their way into the database.
It's already in the stable storage.
The updates are in stable storage, but do you really know that all the updates are in stable storage?
Maybe it's in the shadow or something.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you wrote to the file. You were writing to the file. Writing into a file is not an atomic operation, unless the file fits on one page. When you said write file, it was just writing pages out to the disk, and the system failed. Well, who knows? Maybe they all got out there, maybe they didn't. Maybe you can't even tell. I mean, it may look like, if you opened up the file, it might look like a perfectly good hash table, right? Or a perfectly good instance of your storage class. It just so happens that, half of it is the old version of the storage class and half of it is the new version of the storage class because you only wrote out a few of the pages of the file before the failure. Unless you have some way of knowing that, then you don't know that writing the file is atomic. Yeah. In that case, shouldn't you just redo it again, assuming you have a log? Yeah, if you have a log, that would be a great thing to do. Yeah. But if you don't have a log, then you abort. And that was sort of the idea behind shadow paging, was kind of avoid the need for this extra mechanism for the log.
You can have an different version that says you use the shadow paging and use the partial logging. File is different, it may not be a sequential or anything, and in that case, before you go and switch the flip of the root page and you abort, you can recover it because you have all the shadow page pointers available in the log file. The recovery system will find out and just make the link.
So I think you're describing, I don't want to repeat this, but I think, because I'm not sure I fully agree or understand, but I think what you're doing is you're essentially developing a design for a partial logging system, where you're logging information. You're putting the pages out on disk, you're putting pointers to the pages out. The pointers constitute, in effect, a mini log that's describing the updates of the transaction so that you have it available at recovery time and potentially can redo. There's a lot, if you start thinking, start working down this path, there's a lot of possibilities and design opportunities. So, think it through. That's what the project is about, is to give you the opportunity to think through a design in some detail. Okay, so I'd like to at least talk a little bit about how to do the implementation. We're certainly not going to finish all this tonight. But logging is the most popular way to implement recovery algorithms. All the high-performance systems use it. Oracle, DB2, Microsoft SQL Server, Sybase. They're all logging-based. And you'll see why as we go through the algorithms. But the recovery manager implements the commit operation simply by writing a commit record to the end of the log and flushing the log. That way, the redo rule is satisfied, as I explained earlier. It aborts the transaction by using the transaction's log records to install the before images of any pages that have already been flushed to disk. And it implements restart by scanning the log and undoing and redoing as required, which is a big hand wave at this point. I'm going to have to go through that very slowly and methodically to see how that algorithm works. I want you to learn the logging algorithm. It's one of the most interesting algorithms in data management, and certainly one of the most interesting in this course. And sort of like the variations on locking and the ways of implementing logging are two things that I'd like you to come away with a fairly deep understanding of. That's why I'm kind of doing this slowly, is to bring you to the point where we can really talk about the real algorithm. In a sense, what's going on here is that we're replacing random I.O. by sequential I.O. See, all the updates are being put into the log. They're being appended to the end of the log, and the log is being pushed out to disk at whatever the maximum disk transfer rate is for sequential data. You know, no head movement, in other words. So, you know, you're moving stuff out there at a pretty good clip. And by contrast, if you were to write, you're writing the database pages, you're flushing database pages from the cache to the database, those are typically random updates to different locations on the disk. And on today's disk drives, you're only going to get about 100 to 140 writes per second on a typical disk drive. You know, where you can probably get, what, 10 or 100 times the bandwidth if you write sequentially. And in fact, disks are becoming more and more like sequential devices every year, because the platters get bigger and the heads don't move any faster. They don't spin any, the disk doesn't spin any faster. The disks don't shrink very much anymore, which are the two ways that you get the disk to be able to do more accesses per second. The main way is that you shrink it so that the heads don't have to move as far, and therefore you can move them more times per second. And they get lighter, you know, everything gets smaller, they get lighter weight, and so you end up with less inertia. But, you know, we're down there, 1-inch disks, 1 1/4-inch disk, 2-inch disks, they're just not going to, they seem, we'll see, I don't know, I'm not a hard disk hardware expert, but on the other hand, the densities, the number of bits per square inch, just increases every year. They're very good at getting better bit, finding ways to get better bit density. So if you don't increase the accesses per second, but you do increase the amount of bits, basically you're making it more and more, you're encouraging people more and more to use it as a sequential device. Because if you put the data on it randomly, you can't get enough IOs per second out of the device to get to all the data. The only way to get to the data in a reasonable amount of time is to get to it sequentially. So it's fine if what you're doing is, you know, you're storing a movie, you know, some big video file. But if you're storing bank accounts for different, basically you're just not going to be able to use but a fraction of the bits on the disk for that, because you're only going to get 140 IOs per second to get the data on and off the disk. So what we're doing here is replacing random IO, random reads and writes, to the database by sequential writes to the log. So the cache is, basically the cache is helping us avoid reads, that is fetches, and the log is helping us avoid writes, or avoid random writes. You know, and the combined effect then is to make the system much faster. Alright, so, still in all, every time you flush the log, it does cost you an I.O. And there's some limit to the number of even sequential flushes you can do per second, even without head movement. I forget what the current numbers are. I can look it up. But it's clearly some finite limit on the number of writes per second, even sequentially. But the annoying thing is that at the time you write the commit record into the log, the last page of the log may be partially empty. So here you're writing, you want to commit the transaction. You're writing the page out to the log, and you're not getting the benefit of half of the page on average. And if you're running at a very high transaction rate, this is very inefficient, you know, because the more transactions per second that you're running, the more likely you've got a partially empty page at the end of the log at the time you want to flush the page to do the commit. Now the fact is that it doesn't take that long to flush a page. You know, it's what, a millisecond, 2 milliseconds to get the page out onto the disk. So users can't tell the difference between a few milliseconds. So why not, when you write the commit record to the end of the log, wait, I don't know, 5 or 10 milliseconds before you actually flush the page. Now, there's no guarantee that the page will fill up in 5 or 10 milliseconds. But if the system is very busy, you know, it's really running full tilt, in 5 or 10 milliseconds, that last page is going to fill up for sure. And if the system is not very busy, all right, well, after 5 or 10 milliseconds, you flush the page anyway. I mean, the system's not very busy. You don't need all the disk bandwidth to the log anyway, right? Because the system's not very busy. So you're basically boxcarring lots of updates and commits to make sure you're getting the full benefit of the disk bandwidth under the situation of high transaction load. That's called group commit. Standard algorithm. When processing a commit, if the last log page isn't full, you delay to give it time to fill, and if within the delay period, if the timer goes off and it's still not full, you flush it anyway. But if it's under high load, chances are it's already flushed. By the time the timer goes off, you look and you say, ah, it's already gone. Filled up, the log manager flushed it. Because it basically wants to keep stuff going out to the disk to get the full bandwidth of the disk.
So do you basically block the application from knowing that it's committed until actually the log is flushed?
Do you actually block the transaction from knowing that it's committed until the let's state that more positively. I mean, you don't tell the transaction that the transaction is committed until you know that the commit record is on disk, however long it takes. You're very careful about that. You know, and there are all these handshakes going on. I'm sure, you know, you're sort of wondering whether, you know, systems are really that careful at that level of the system. Believe me, they are. I mean, and you've just seen the tip of the iceberg here. You know, we're going to get into much more detail on it. But it's all this handshaking is done extremely carefully. That make sure that the log, you know, you wait, and it's not enough to just issue the write operation to the log. You actually have to get an acknowledgement from the log manager that that last page of the log is actually on the disk. And the log manager isn't going to give you that acknowledgement until it has had a handshake with the disk, which is to say, it wrote the disk block, it got the interrupt back saying the I.O. is complete, and at that point it understands which I.O. that was, and it passes back an acknowledgement to the commit operations or to the log writes that asked for an acknowledgement at that time, when at that point it knows they're out on disk. Now, not all updates to the log are force writes that require handshaking with the disk, otherwise this would be way too slow. But for the ones that are, all that handshaking is taking place. Well, this is more than a minute even for the last bullet. Let's stop here, take another break, and then I'll do some more logging before the end. So suppose you have two data managers. This is the last bullet now on the same slide. Suppose you have two data managers on a machine, and they're both, the transaction can access both of them. It would be nice if they shared a log. Well, if they have separate logs, then you have to run two-phase commit. Right? Because if they have separate logs, they're going to be committed independently. And even though they're on the same computer, it's the same old problem. You know, you committed one, then the system fails, and now the other one's out of luck. So you have, you know, it would be nice if they could share a log. And this has been done occasionally, commercially, but it's rare. It's also very nice. It's efficient because if you've got if you have two data managers, like typically what happens is sometimes there's a message manager that's recording messages or queued messages, and then a database system that's storing database stuff. And if you can put it all in the same log, then of course the system's going to run a lot faster because you can flush both logs together when the transaction commits instead of having to flush them independently. But it's something to look, but it just doesn't come up commercially all that often. It's really complicated, basically, because of the conflicting requirements that two or more data managers might have in how to read and write the log. All right, so that was implementing commit. What about implementing abort? Well, the way we're going to implement abort is we're assuming that this is an algorithm that requires undo. You know, if we don't require undo, then we can just throw out the updates. But if we're going to allow updates to be propagated to the database, then we have to undo all the updates. And the way this is normally done is that the log records of a transaction are threaded back through the log, where each log record for a transaction has a pointer to the previous log record for the same transaction. All right? So they're basically, there's a whole chain of them, starting with the last log record for the transaction. There's a chain going all the way back to the first update performed by the transaction. And so to abort a transaction, you have in main memory, you've got a list of all the active transactions. These are called transaction descriptors. And one of the pieces of information that's maintained for each transaction descriptor is a pointer to the last log record. And that log record has the transaction ID, the page ID, before and after image, and a back pointer to the previous log record from the same transaction. And then, of course, the last log record just has a null back pointer. So now how do you do abort? Well, you just start from the end and you start restoring before images. Go to the last log record for the transaction, install its before image. Then you go to the last update from the transaction. You install that one's before image. You just go back until they're all exhausted. Notice one nice thing about this is it works even if the transaction updated a page twice. Think about it. If the transaction updated a page twice, the before image of the second update is not the original state of the page. The before image of the last update is equal to the after image of the first update. And so you want to undo them going from the end back to the beginning, because then you don't have to bookkeep this problem, right? It just falls out automatically by undoing in this reverse order.
This only works if you have strict serialization.
If the concurrency control algorithm is strict, yes. Remember, the reason you can't overwrite uncommitted data. If you could overwrite uncommitted data, then this wouldn't work, as I explained earlier. I mean, if you can imagine just sort of looking at the code, you know, down at this low level of the system, you know, you can pick apart the code line by line, you know, and say, well, this lock is ensuring it's strict. This one is doing the undo because of the undo rule. This one is, and so on. Almost every couple of instructions, you see one of these rules pop up. How do I know transaction 7 must be aborted? So there's two possibilities. One is, well, right now we're just implementing abort, not restart. So the reason why we're aborting transaction is somebody issued the abort operation, either directly from the application, or maybe the transaction deadlocked and the system forced the transaction to abort. But I haven't gotten to the restart case, which will be another reason to abort, but that's implementing restart. Coming momentarily. Okay?
Remember the write-ahead log protocol? That implements the undo rule. The write-ahead log protocol says, make before you write an after image to the stable database, make sure the before image is in the log. So there's a handshake there. You've got this dirty page in cache. The cache manager wants to write it to the stable database, but first it has to make sure that all of the updates to the page, which are recorded in the log, are actually out there on the disk. How does it do it? Very simple. The way it works is, first of all, every log record has an address in the log. And for historical reasons, it's called the log sequence number, LSN. Okay? So log sequence number means log address, effectively. Remember we went through this whole sequence of fetch, pin, lock, latch, write the page, log the update. One more thing now. In the page descriptor for this page that we just updated, record the log sequence number of that log record we just wrote so that the cache manager remembers that that was the last update to the page. So in addition to the dirty bit and the cache address and the pin count, there's one more piece of information here, which is the log address, the log sequence number of the last update to that page. Now that's all you need in order to satisfy the write-ahead log protocol. Because at the time you write, so you've got this dirty page in cache, you want to write it to disk, and the question is, has the log record corresponding to the last update to that page gone out to disk? That's it. If the answer is yes, then all the previous updates to that page have also gone out to disk in the log, and they all have the before image of the their respective updates. So if the log record for the last update to the page is on the disk, then it's safe to write the after image of the page to the stable database because you have the information to undo. Now, in fact, the chances that you actually have to flush that last log record to the log is very small. I mean, you all know cache replacement strategies. Which pages do you replace in cache usually? Right? It's usually the ones that you haven't used recently, right? Well, if you haven't used it recently, chances are then the last update to that page was done a while ago, which means that the log record for that page, that last update, is almost certainly in the log. So to flush the page, all you have to do is check to find out ask the log manager, what is the log sequence number of the last log record that went out to disk? That's it. Very, very, very fast. Just log manager, tell me what that is. And if it's already gone out to disk, it's satisfied. Now, in fact, what you want is you want to say, what you really want to do is tell the log manager, I need to know when this log address has gone out to disk. So you call it and say, let me know when that log address has gone out to disk. And then, of course, hopefully, the vast majority of the time, it will just come back immediately and say, it's already on disk. Be zero delay. All it has to do is check its local memory to see what the log address is of the last log record it flushed. Notice that the log sequence number needs to be updated while the latch is held on the cache slot. That's all part of the update sequence, because you not only want the update records to go out to the log in the correct order, you also want the log sequence number to always reflect the last update to that page. If you release the latch early, then again, just like the log records could get out of order, the updates to the cache descriptor could get out of order. Okay? All right. Preliminaries are done. Let's do restart. So, we've been very careful about all of this, you know. We've been writing stuff to the log in the right order, and we know how to do aborts, and we know how to do commits, and we've made sure that the write-ahead log protocol is satisfied. All the machinery is in place. That log is perfect. Now all we have to do is interpret it at recovery time. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to scan the log. Now, there's a bunch of ways of doing it. I'm going to go through a sequence of ways. This is says rev 1. All right, there's going to be a couple of revs here. But so rev 1 is and we're assuming both undo and redo are required. So that means you can write uncommitted updates to the database, but you don't have to put all of them in the database before the transaction commits. You just have to put them in the log. All right? So the way we're going to do it is we're going to scan the log from the end back to the beginning, and we're going to figure out which transactions committed and aborted. And we need to do it from the end because when we actually want to go through and scan forward and redo updates, we need to know which transactions committed and aborted. You know what? So in other words, how to say this? You need to do aborts from the end in any case, because we already said we want to do, you know, we want to back the aborts are back threaded. The update records for aborted transactions are back threaded, and we're going to follow them in the reverse order. So we want to do that in any case, and then to know what the state of a transaction is, we have to. The way we're going to figure that out is by figuring out what is the last operation that we in the log for that transaction. There are only three possibilities, right? We're scanning the log from the end back to the beginning. For a given transaction, if we hit a commit record, then we know the transaction committed. If we hit an abort record, we know the transaction aborted. And if we hit an update record, we know the transaction was active. And a convenient way to figure that out is just start from the end and go scan back toward the beginning. All right, so here we are. We've rebooted. We're going to start at the end of the log. Now, where is the end of the log? How do we know where the end of the log is? I mean, come on, right? What's the big deal? You have a pointer on the disk that points to the end of the log. Really? Is that what you're going to do? Every time you append another block to the log, you're going to update this pointer that points to the end of the log? That doesn't sound good. Well, you might say, well, you know, we know roughly where it is at the end of the log. Maybe what we do is we have a pointer to the end of the log, but it's a pointer to the last, I don't know, 5 cylinders of the log. Because we're probably going to need at least that much of the log to read it anyway. So we don't need to update that pointer to the end of the log very often. So we'll just update it periodically, pointing to like the last 5 cylinders of the log, and then, you know, we'll put, every time we get close to the end, we'll add some more. So we only have to update the pointer to the end of the log periodically. So we're going to read in the last 5 cylinders. And the end of the log is somewhere in those last 5 cylinders. We're going to have to scan it all anyway. No big deal, right? Because we're going to have to look up all the commit and abort records and figure out what to undo. So we haven't really created that much extra work for ourselves. But we still have not answered the question, where is the end of the log? And you might say, well, it's easy, you know. Some of the pages are obviously formatted, you know, to be part of the log. They've got, you know, the right header information and everything else. You know, and you put some special code in there so you can tell which are the log pages, and the others are, you know, are not. They're just garbage from whatever, you know, was there before. That's great for the first pass through the disk. Right? But, I mean, you know, this log, I mean, this disk is going to be used for a while as the log, right? So, the second time through the disk, every page on the disk looks like a log page. So that's not going to work either. What do you do? Yeah, you have a sequence number of how many passes you've made through the disk.
You have an LSN, right?
Well, the LSN... If the LSNs never have, if they never wrap, then that would be a way to do it. Then you could just use the LSN, the largest LSN. The LSNs are in the record. I haven't actually said that, but if the LSNs actually go inside the record, then you could use that to figure out where the end of the log is. Now the LSNs are going to get big in order to make sure they never wrap this way. But that would, or if they do wrap, then you have to do something very special with the log.
What about the timestamp?
Timestamp. You could put a timestamp in there. That would be another possibility. Yeah.
You have a page header saying that this is the page, which is the end of the file, end of the log. So you have special header for the page that would denote the end of the log.
Well, I don't understand. A special page that would denote the end of the log.
Each page has a header.
Yes.
So in the header, there will be information where it's the last page.
Yeah, but then what happens when I add the next page? No. One thing, okay, so you have to clean up the previous one. You don't want to do that, right? You don't want to keep overwriting. And in particular, remember how disks work. So you've written a page to the end of the log, and it said transaction 7 committed. You don't want to be overwriting that page. Because if you do, and the write operation fails, you've just uncommitted a transaction that you already committed and acknowledged to the user. Right? Think of the sequence. I've written the last page to the log on disk. I, the recovery manager, now know the transaction 7 has committed, and I acknowledge all the way back up to the application. And now, when I add another page to the end of the log, you're suggesting maybe I should overwrite the previous... You're convinced? Okay. No. Okay. All right. This is not like the world's most important problem, you know, finding the end of the log. But, hey, Eva? Yeah?
Can you reserve a very big file, fill it up with news, and then when you need to find the end, you go to the...
Yeah. So one thing you could do is you could prep the disk. Every time you could prepare the disk or the region of the disk for the log, every time you want to use it, that of course is going to cost you. And probably you want to keep reusing the same disk as the log. So you could do that. I don't think anybody does, but because there's a lot of, it takes a long time to write all the bits on the disk to clear it out. I'm basically want to show you. I'm just trying to show you sort of the range. The level of thinking that has to go on when you really have to trust what's on the disk and nothing else. And at recovery time, that's all there is to work with. You have to do this very methodically. Even simple problems like finding the end of a file turn into major engineering design problem. Yeah.
So if every time you rooted, keep a back pointer in every record to the place that you should jump to and then reverse by one and see where it overwrote. So you could start anywhere and kind of skip your way.
Yeah, so the observation is that you could write some information that would kind of give you a hint as to where to begin the scan. And in fact, I'm going to tell you how to do that at some point. That is basically how it's done. I said the last five cylinders as just kind of a, because I haven't given you enough information yet to be able to say how it's really done, but it amounts to that kind of insight, that that you're going to periodically write, there's going to be a couple, and you're going to write it a couple places because you don't ever want to have to scan the whole disk. If you ever lose that pointer, then you're going to be scanning a huge amount of the disk to find the end of the log. So you want that to be pretty reliable. Store it in a couple places. All right, so we found the end of the log, and we're scanning backwards toward the beginning of the log. And as we hit records, we're going to be building up a list of committed transactions and a list of recovered pages. Initially, they're both empty. All right. If we hit a commit record, we're going to add the transaction to the list of committed the list of committed transactions. If we hit an update record for a page by a transaction, if the page is not on the recovered list, then what we're going to do is we're going to add it to the recovered list, and if T is in the commit list, then we'll redo the update. Otherwise, we're going to undo the update. Now, this works as long as a transaction doesn't overwrite a page, right? If it only writes each page once. Otherwise, the undo is not guaranteed to finish the job. The undo is not guaranteed. If you would have to actually go and abort the transaction in order to make sure the page is completely undone. But so basically, we're using the commit list. The commit list is there to tell us whether to undo or redo updates that we're coming across in the log. You know, and at this point, we don't know which of these updates have actually made it out into the stable database. So we kind of have to undo and redo all of them until we've gone back far enough that we're sure that they've all been done. And the question is, how far is that? Well, on the face of it, it's the beginning of the log, unless we do something a little more clever. So what we're going to do is we're going to periodically synchronize the log with the state of the database. All right, this is a form of checkpointing. There are many kinds of checkpointing. This is one, and this is one algorithm to do it. So what we're going to do is we're going to periodically stop processing transactions. We're going to make a list of all the active transactions, and for each active transaction, we're going to have a pointer to the last log record in the log for that transaction. And we're going to take that list, and we're going to write it to the log. We're going to write that list to the log. So we have the log will have in it a list of all the transactions that were active at that moment in time that we wrote it to the log, along with pointers to the last log record for each of them. So if we have to abort them, we'll have the information we need. Right. And then we're going to take all the dirty pages in cache, and we're going to flush them to the database. Now, you might say, well, but how can you do that? Some of the pages are pinned. Well, we're going to have to wait for them to all be unpinned. You know, we're not going to allow any more pin operations, and we're going to wait for all the pages to be unpinned. I mean, we can start flushing as soon as some of them are available to be flushed, but we won't complete this operation until every page in memory is unpinned and all the dirty ones have been flushed. Right? Now we're going to take that checkpoint record. When that's all done, and we've gotten acknowledgments from the disk for all those operations, now we're going to take that checkpoint record, we're going to append it to the end of the log, and we're going to flush it. Now, what does that log record tell us? That log record tells us that every update preceding that log record is in the stable database and does not have to be redone. That checkpoint record in the log is a firewall, if you will, against redo. Now, it's not a firewall against undo, but what it says is if we start at the end, now think about restart again. If we start at the end of the log and go back, when we hit that checkpoint record, we know no more redo required. All we have to do is ask ourselves, are any of the transactions in that checkpoint record uncommitted? If any of them are not on the commit list, then we're going to have to undo them. At least those pages which have not already been undone. Right? Okay. So that's the restart algorithm. That's the top half now of this page. So we start from the last. So actually, we can make this even easier now. Instead of starting from the end of the log, we can start from the last checkpoint record and scan the log forward to the end. And basically, we redo all updates and process all aborts. Right? And when we're all done, any transactions that are still active must be aborted. Right? So we have to keep track of active transactions now during the forward scan. So this is a little bit different. So we start at the last checkpoint record, and we have a list of active transactions, which is the list that we got out of the checkpoint record. Right? And as transactions commit, we cross them off the active list. And whenever we see an update record for a transaction that we haven't seen before, we add it to the active list. And so as we see commits, we cross off. So we're adding transactions to the active list. We're crossing them off the active list as they become committed. At the end of the process, when we finally hit the end of the log, now we still may have some transactions on the active list. Well, by definition, they have to abort. They were active at the time of failure, so we'll just abort them. And some of them may even have been active at the last checkpoint, which is why it's handy to have back pointers from there. So that we know how far back in the log we have to maintain information. Okay? Now, notice that in this algorithm, restart time is proportional to the amount of log after the last checkpoint. Remember I said I wanted restart to be fast because the system is not available while we're running restart. So in order to be fast, we have to checkpoint frequently. But if you think about it, checkpointing is pretty expensive because you've got to flush all the dirty pages from cache, even the ones that are frequently accessed. That's going to cost you. It's going to take a while. Moreover, while you're checkpointing, you can't do anything else because you can't write to the log because you want. If you start allowing other updates while you're doing the checkpoint, then the checkpoint record that you write is no longer going to have the intended meaning. Right? So you really have to prevent all updates from happening while you're flushing the cache so that when you write that last checkpoint record at the end of the log, it really means that all the previous updates are in the database. Otherwise, there would be this funny synchronization going on where checkpointing would be writing out the dirty pages, but even while it's writing out dirty pages, more pages are becoming dirty, and it somehow has to eventually get into a state where the entire cache is clean so it can actually write out a checkpoint record to indicate that the log and the database are mutually consistent. I mean, it might never happen, right? Because the updates keep coming, even maybe faster than the cache. So you can if you want to visually imagine this, that the cache manager has this big broom and it's trying to sweep the cache clean, and while it's sweeping as fast as it can, but while it's sweeping, the transactions keep coming in, throwing dirt into the cache. And there's no guarantee that the cache manager will ever catch up, that the checkpointing algorithm will ever catch up. So what you really want to do is fuzzy checkpointing. This will be the last, a few minutes. This will be the last step. I'm going to probably repeat this on Thursday just to. So the way you're going to do checkpoints is you're going to stop accepting new updates, commit, and abort operations just like before. But instead of flushing all the pages in cache right away, you're just going to make a list of all the dirty pages in the cache. You'll also make a list of all the active transactions, as we did before. And we're going to, right now, before we do anything with the cache, we're going to add a checkpoint record to the log, which includes the list. Has the list of all the active transactions, just like before. But we haven't actually flushed the cache. Right? After we've written the record, this checkpoint record, now what we're going to do is we're going to start flushing all of the pages that are on the list of dirty pages that we made a moment ago. It's going to take us some time. Right? But when we're done, we want to do it slowly because we don't want to slow down active transactions. That's sort of the whole point, right? Because we said that the previous checkpointing algorithm was very expensive because it had to shut down and it had to flush the whole cache. So now we're not going to do that. We are going to flush all the dirty pages that were dirty as of the time of the last checkpoint, but we're going to do it slowly in the background whenever there's disk capacity, low priority writes. You got to make sure you got enough disk capacity to do this, but that it'll eventually all the writes will go out. When they do, when that all the writes for that list of dirty pages has gone out, we're going to run a second checkpoint, just like the previous one. That is to say, we're going to go back into the cache, and we're going to see which pages are dirty. We're going to write a checkpoint record, and then we're going to start flushing the dirty pages. Which pages are those? Well, those are the pages that became dirty while we were flushing the pages that were dirty as of the previous checkpoint. So we sort of do this waves, right? At each checkpoint, we make a list of all the dirty pages, and at the end of the checkpoint, we run another checkpoint again, and this time for the next set of dirty pages. So think about the checkpoint records in the log. The last checkpoint record in the log is actually meaningless. But the second to last checkpoint record has the desired interpretation. Because we would not have written the last checkpoint record until we knew that all the pages that were dirty at the time of the second to last checkpoint record were on the disk. So it's always the second to last checkpoint record that's significant. There's an English word for that, penultimate. The penultimate checkpoint is the checkpoint that really matters. And it has exactly the same interpretation as it did before. So now we do exactly the same recovery algorithm we did before. We start at the penultimate checkpoint and we go forward doing all the updates, keeping track of all the active and committed transactions. When we see an abort, aborting the updates, and at the end, any transactions that are still active at the end, we abort them. So the nice thing about this is that basically we can checkpoint as often as we have disk capacity to do it. The only thing that prevents us from checkpointing really, really often is that we don't have enough spare disk bandwidth to get all those dirty pages out into the database. So as long as you're careful to have enough disk I/O capacity to be able to handle the write load that you're getting, then you can run these checkpoints very, very often. If you run them often, then the tail of the log from the penultimate checkpoint to the end will be relatively short, which means the amount of work that you have to do at recovery time will be pretty well bounded. Everybody does this. I mean, to a first approximation. This is how you checkpoint often and get recovery to run fast. But this is all under the assumption of page level locking. What I want to do next is record level, and we will resume that discussion on Thursday.